Welcome to Warships Pod and a two-part discussion with Lee Pilgrim, a returning guest, about the decline of the Royal Navy since the 1990s and what to do about it. In part two of our discussion, Lee and I will look at the failure of strategic vision in the UK when it comes to its Navy, what can be learned from the Second World War, while also considering the future of Britannia Royal Naval College Dartmouth and what may happen there as training in the Royal Navy is shaken up, and a look at the Iran War and the decision to commit a British destroyer to operations east of Suez. Welcome, Lee. Great to have you on again.
Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you on here, Lee. Again, it comes back to the politics. It seems to me that what aligns with the politics of the current government, or in fact previous governments, is that what they really like is stuff that is in the future, because they could kick the can down the road. They could talk about massive amounts of investment and jobs and things like that coming along, and they kick it down the road, but they don't actually have to take any hard decisions right now. And it's good for selfies in Australia when they're talking about AUKUS, or go to a carrier in the Mediterranean and get another selfie on the carrier. And then, as you say, it's the hard decisions you need to take right now to dig in and actually save what's left of the Royal Navy and make sure the new Royal Navy happens. And the other thing I think is very pernicious, which really started to creep in from the Conservative Lib Dem coalition time and their Security and Defence Review back in 2010, was the idea that you could take a capability holiday and it's all right, it's great, because your allies will help train your personnel when you can't train them. And now, I mean, today we've got the Perisher course for submarine commanders. We have to borrow a Norwegian submarine to do that. And in the past, we were borrowing, inverted commas, Hornets flying from Super Hornet jets, flying from American aircraft carriers to keep our fast jet pilots going. And now, you mentioned it a moment ago, which is fine. All of this is fine within an alliance, because Dragon is away now going east of Suez to wait to see what happens with the Iran war. We're putting a Commodore and command staff for a NATO squadron, and the Royal Navy very rarely contributes to those permanent NATO naval squadrons these days anyway. But she is currently on board a German frigate, which is not unusual. It's been done in the past and it's quite normal. But if I was a foreign navy, like the Japanese, like the Germans, whoever, the Americans, and I'm looking at the Royal Navy in the UK in particular, and it goes across all the armed forces, saying, oh, it's okay, the Allies will do it. They'll help us keep our capability. They'll look after us. They'll train our people. We'll take a 10-year holiday. We won't get these ships into service. And they can step in and they can fill the gaps. And it's like there's said to be a French nuclear powered attack submarine helping to protect the Trident missile submarines at the moment whenever they deploy. Yeah. And that's another example. We can't get any to sea. We're not spending the money on it to get them to sea, but the French will step in. And it just seems that only humiliating for the nation, but a very stupid thing to do if political objectives do not align in any future crisis or war. And they say, well, we're not going to help you. I mean, you can look at the Norwegians. The Norwegians are getting Type 26 frigates off the British production line, so delaying the introduction to service of more Type 26 frigates into the Royal Navy. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to work with the Norwegians and they're great, they're our buddies. But what if a new government comes in Norway and says, actually, we're buddies with the Russians and we're not going to commit our warships and our people to saving the backside of Britain? So do you think there's a whole real set of troubles and problems being set up by that as well?
Admiral Blount said it best. I hope I pronounced his name right. At the Sea Power conference, when he said, you know, NATO can see that the UK is not stepping up, you know, with the rhetoric that it's coming up with. And that's both land, sea, and air. If you look at what the French are doing at the moment, so people always point at the fact the French have only got one aircraft carrier. Been pretty well used at the moment. They managed to get that group from Norway or from wherever they were in the Baltics around into the Mediterranean. And now they're sending it off into the Middle East. So there is a country with roughly the same size population, the same size budget as us, and managing to deploy a carrier strike group out to do the things that their taxpayer expects them to be able to do. We roughly the same budget. Yeah, we've got HMS Dragon that had to be rushed out of maintenance to arrive 10 days late to go and then go to Suda Bay so she could do all the other stuff that she needed to be able to do. When we look at the Norwegians and Type 26, I noted earlier in your comments when you mentioned the two numbers, 8 or 6. There'll be those in the Treasury that will be looking at the number 6. There'll be those in the MOD that are looking at the number 12. I don't look at either of those numbers. I look at the amount of trained people that we have available to actually man the platforms that we've got. Whether it's 6 or 8, it's irrelevant. Unless you've got trained people to actually put on board those platforms to put it to sea, this is a reason why over the last 10 years, you know, HMS Daring has been constantly turned up alongside. We just do not have the crews. We do not have the ship's companies to crew all the platforms that we've got available. So what's the point in going out more if we don't have the people, the trained people to do it? You mentioned their perisher. I remember someone writing a book, because I read it in my younger life, about SSNs. You know, whilst everybody sort of, you know, wows at the US Navy and their submarine fleet, everybody silently fears the British because of their perisher course and the way that we operate our submarines. There's nothing to fear at the moment because all our submarines are in various levels of decay alongside waiting for a maintenance slot. So what happens to all of those ships' companies on those submarines? Do they get skills atrophy? Are they doing full tours on that submarine without ever going to sea? You know, it just seems a bit, you know, rotten. So going to the back to the point where I was mentioning the future, unless you've got a stable base to build on, there is no future to build on. There is nothing there. There is no foundation to build on if it's all being eroded away. Capability holidays, you know, taking the carriers away in 2010, taking the Harriers away in 2010. How long did it take to generate that capability? If we look at F-35, we still do not have the number of pilots, you know, to be able to sustain operations. When CSG-25 came back and it was going through the Med and we managed to, I think, for a couple of days, get 24 aircraft on board, that took all the combat-ready pilots, that took all the QFIs, that took all the QFIs. You know, it took the whole force to go down there just so they could get a photo op and the MOD could sign a milestone to say, look, we can put 24 aircraft on an aircraft carrier. What did that prove? It didn't prove anything. Hmm. It just shows that, again, it's short-termism. What's the next fix? It's like running around a ship, plugging holes, you know, going around a Type 23 every day, plugging the holes and saying, we are really, really good at plugging holes. Brilliant. Well done. There's the badge. You know, it's what about the Type 26? What about the Type 31? What about all the other stuff that you have to fix? It's a cultural malaise within the service. And if you're Treasury and you're looking across and you're saying, guys, I'm not giving you any more money because you don't seem to be able to manage the money that we give you. You know, you're paying for the next shiny when we're looking at the technical debt that you're building up. You know, those submarines are coming out. Look at the technical debt, you know, the floating dock. Oh, we're still in a study to work out if we need a floating dock. Why? You know, it just seems odd. We need a floating dock. Go and buy a floating dock. You know, we need maintenance facilities. Go and make those maintenance facilities available. Oh, we might not be able to pay for some of the future. Oh, well, we'll pay for the now. And going on your other point, because I do ramble on quite a bit, governments are very good planning for things that they don't have to pay for. And then when they're out of government, they can blame the new government for not delivering them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the submarine infrastructure decisions were taken over the past 30 years. I mean, they were, without getting too technical about it, the fact that, you know, you couldn't use the dry docks at Devonport, or you have no floating dock and the shiplift shed is in trouble. That, you know, those were incremental decisions that took place over 30 years. And as you're right, the people that took them, the ministers, the people in the Navy and the people in the MOD that took or did not take those decisions, they would have taken them for short-term reasons to save money, you know, delaying the Dreadnought-class submarines, the new Trident missile submarines that will replace the current Vanguard-class. That was the Conservatives that did that to save money. And so now it's costing money because you now have to run on the Vanguard class, which are old, 30 years old, and you have to spend more money refitting them, and they take a long time to refit. And then the ones that are still in service, 2 or 3 that are not in dock, they then get worn out. It's the same across the whole piece. It's a staggering failure of strategic vision and also understanding the value of what you need to put in and doing it and anticipating. I mean, we could, if we brought it back to today's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, I read somewhere today or the other day that he doesn't believe in having a vision. That may be wrong. That may be something that somebody's claimed it is actually not accurate. But maybe he's not the only one. There must have been politicians before that, David Cameron, George Osborne, whoever they were, Nick Clegg, you know, who are fixated on short-term things and they have no actual unifying vision, and certainly not in defence. I mean, if you look at Winston Churchill during the Second World War, I mean, that was a guy who was a navalist, a pain to the Navy because he kept insisting on certain things they didn't want to do. But they did admire him, maybe sometimes grudgingly, and he was interested and he was passionate. So Britain in 1941 is looking disaster in the face. It's struggling to introduce surface search radar to try and track U-boats on the surface, sinking merchant vessels. It's got various weapons coming. It's got old ships it needs to refit and up arm so it can tackle the U-boats. It's got to protect the convoys. There's escort carriers coming in. It's working all these multitudinous things. And Churchill sits down when the Germans are having arguably their best success in spring of 1941, early 1941, spring of 1941, in sinking ships and convoys. And he declares the Battle of the Atlantic. He says, we must have a multi-level effort, whether it's offloading cargoes, the time you turn around merchant ships, whether it's using people to reroute convoys away from where the U-boats are, or it's the technology of killing them, of hunting them, of destroying them. We must have, and he had vision. He had vision, action this day. So it's the vision not being met with, as you've just outlined, the resources or the actual focus that we need today. And I do think that some politicians and others are thinking, God, if we could just hang on long enough and not worry about the sunk cost of the Royal Navy, then these drones, they're going to be like Skynet. We'll have our own version of Skynet from the Terminator films, and they will save us. And we won't have to bother with these pesky people that we seem to not be able to recruit because we've got a completely inefficient system. Thousands of people out there who could join the military, enough that you need. You don't have to start importing people from anywhere else, apart from where you already get them in the Commonwealth. What you actually need to do is have an efficient, and we can move this on to recruitment and training now, is it needs to have efficient recruiting system that enables the tens of thousands of people that give up each year, or you can't process, or never get to being trained, to actually get into the Navy. Oh, and provide the money and accommodation, of course, as well. So is that part of it as well?
Yeah. So if you, going back to the Churchill, that was a campaign. So the Atlantic campaign, they had a focus point. He said, we have a problem here. Someone needs to come in to fix the problem. So he appointed someone, can't remember the chap's name, it's a civilian, that came in to say, this is the problem that needs fixing. So you can draw everything together to say, here is the thing that we need to fix. Does the Royal Navy have that now? Does the country have that now? Probably not. We've got a thing that's going on in the North Atlantic. We've got a thing that's going on in the Gulf. We've got a thing that's going on in Ukraine. In the late 1990s, when George Robertson did his SDSR, there was a vision there. We're going to be a global navy and we're going to interfere where it's right and proper to do so. So there was a vision and there was a mission. So vision, mission, but there was no execution. The money was never made available to do the execution. Since the Second World War, we've probably had only two leaders that have had a vision that have managed to carry most of it out. One was Margaret Thatcher. The other one was Tony Blair, both in office for about 11 or 12 years, but they were given, you know, they had the time and the space to do the things that they wanted to do, to set, you know, that's why we call it the Thatcher years, the Blair years. That tells you that they, you know, it's an epoch change in the way a country does something. If you look at the politicians between them, from Major to Brown to Cameron to May to whoever, you know, they are not defined by the era that they were in power. Whereas you can say the Churchill years, the Thatcher years, or the Blair years, these were periods of time that where things were changed. You know, you've got to look at the Royal Navy and say, what do you want to use your Royal Navy for? I don't think the government have got the answer for that at the moment. And I don't think the Royal Navy are articulating a good enough argument to say, this is what you can use us for. Outside of the deterrent and outside of sending a carrier around the world every 4 years on a gym tour, you know, which is great for the sailors on board because they get to see the world, because that's why you join the Navy after all. But look at the damage it causes the Navy when those groups go out. You know, look how much it strips from the Royal Navy. I think it's HMS Richmond that went out there. When she came back, she was decommissioned on arrival because, you know, she'd run her life.
Have they admitted that yet? Or is this going to be like Iron Duke? They finally admit it, even though we've speculated.
Yeah, you know, and again, with Iron Duke, you've got to go digging around and you've got to go looking for it to say, you know, where's the plan? Where's the, you know, what is the Royal Navy there to do outside of CASD? Until that clear, and that's what the SDR was supposed to help do, to say this, you know, for the maritime domain, this is where we're going to use the Royal Navy. You know, in the late 90s again, Commando 2000. So Commando 2000 was created to allow the Royal Marines at brigade size to be able to deploy ashore. So for that, you had HMS Ocean, two LPDs, four bays, and six roll-on, roll-off ferries and all the other things to say this is, you know, and there was a big advertising campaign. It was even done in the Herald. I can remember it in the Herald at the time. That's the Evening Herald down in Plymouth, to say here is Commando 2000. And it incentivized people to join the Royal Marines, to join the Royal Navy, because they're going to go around the world and they're going to generate effect. You know, speaking from a Royal Marine point of view, speaking to a couple of them last week, and they're not going anywhere. They're not doing anything because there's no vessels for them to go out and do it on, you know. And they've got no, when they're looking to the future, they say, you know, what within the amphibious space are we going to be doing? There's nothing there for them to see apart from being told, oh, no, you're going to become 12-man soft teams, which sounds cool and it looks cool on paper. You know, where's the implementation of that? I go back to that, you know, that vision, mission, execution thing. Where's the execution of that vision? And is it a true vision, or is it a vision that's been constrained by the fact the Royal Navy either doesn't have the money or it's not being given the scope to do the things it's there to do? It's, like I said, we are stuck at the bottom of the V and there are people looking up at the top of the other side going, look, it's going to be sunny on the other end. We're going to have these hybrid drones. No one quite knows what they mean. We're going to have this and we're going to have that. And it's, you know, the realist is looking back to say, guys, you can't even make the first step to get to where you want to be. You know, where you are at the moment, I'll go back to the list. The list of assets that you've got is getting smaller and smaller. And if you're people that's looking to join the Royal Navy, what are you going to sail on? You know, you're looking at all the press that's going out at the moment and say, what's the point of me joining the Royal Navy if I'm going to spend 4 years at Collingwood or 4 years at Drake or you know, or 4 years up at Faz Lane? I don't need to join the Royal Navy to do that. I can do that in any job that's out there. And I don't have to wear a uniform. You know, people join the Royal Navy to go to sea. It's not much at sea at the moment.
No. You say SOFT, you mean Special Operations Forces.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Royal Marines, that's that kind of transformation into these different roles other than being a brigade that goes ashore in a
yeah.
in an amphibious assault or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
The thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about a little while earlier in our chat was the head of one of the Baltic fleets was interviewed in the magazine, and I've been looking for the actual interview recently. And he said that although he had a tiny navy made up of ex Royal Navy mine hunters and other vessels that they've acquired, you know, over the past 20, 30 years from other places, in essence, what he was saying was, and if I could find the quote, I'd read you the actual quotes. But in essence, what he was saying was that the main thing is if you have something, if you have a vessel and you have units, you can build on it. And that's something to build on. And if you don't have anything, you cannot build a navy. You cannot build on operations. So that's where I think the Royal Navy maybe is at the moment across the board, is it's now getting to such a low threshold in terms of its mass that it can't, as you say, get people to sea, get Royal Marines out there, can't get sailors out to sea, submariners, it can't get aircraft to sea. It's got nothing to build on to then generate the interest, the excitement, and the rationale for having a navy. And so it's a kind of vicious circle where it just goes round and round and round. And it's quite extraordinary, as somebody else has pointed out on social media, that we are the fifth or the sixth largest economy in the world? We're in the G7, and this is where it's come. It's quite extraordinary. It's quite an achievement for governments over the past 30 years to actually do that.
It is. And if you know, we use the dip. So one of the reasons why the dip is, you know, people talk about the £28 billion gap between the aspiration and, you know, the budget available. £18 billion of that there or thereabouts is to pay for current projects that have overrun their scope, their budget, or whatever it is. So you can see why the Treasury is a bit reticent about giving new money to pay for old. If I'm a young lad, if I'm a young guy coming in and I'm looking, I live in Plymouth and I'm looking to join the Royal Navy, I wouldn't be that optimistic in being able to go to sea by looking at the fact that, or Portsmouth even better. All I have to do, because I think the photos are taken every day, is I just have to look out onto the estuary to see the legacy Navy that's sat there waiting to be towed off to get scrapped. And then looking at the Navy that's actually available that I can go to sea on, you know, what is there? And when you get that atrophy where you get to the mass is so small, it gets very, very difficult to recapitalize. You know, the Second World War was a different point where you could recapitalize that mass very, very quickly. We're not going to be in that position again. So where is that recapitalization going to come from? If they put a couple of Type 26s out there, I go back to the thing, where are they going to find the ship's companies to actually crew them? You know, one of the reasons, for example, why Iron Duke is now offline is because they needed some of her crew to go onto HMS Kent. Well, hang on a minute. We've got 20,000 people in the Royal Navy, yet we can't, you know, the remaining ships that we have, we can't crew them. What are all these people doing? Where are all these people within that system? It seems very inefficient when we have all of these people in the Royal Navy, that's excluding Royal Marines, yet we seem to struggle to get ships out to sea. You know, the Carrier Strike Group, in inverted commas, that's going up to Norway at the moment. I think that one destroyer, one aircraft carrier with no aircraft, because people like to mention that every now and again, and an auxiliary. Carrier Strike Group 21 was one aircraft carrier, two frigates, two destroyers, a submarine, and a couple of auxiliaries. Then Carrier Strike Group 25 was a bit smaller. Here we are now with our Carrier Strike Group that's got three vessels. I'm sure there's probably still an amphibious task group commander out there somewhere as well. What he or she is currently commanding, I have no idea. You know, it's once these things start to go, you start to lose the skills within those positions, that two-star position, because the two-star position needs you to have done a one-star post where you've commanded something, but there's no one available. That one-star post needs a captain's post where you've done X, but no one's available. All of a sudden, you know, you start to lose that skill set. So when we do go to sea and we go off and do something, we're going with people in authority that don't necessarily have the skills to meet what they're there to do. Last time that happened was in the Falklands, you know, where you had vessels going to sea that weren't quite ready to go and do the things they were required to do down in the Falklands. You know, if that happens again, who have we got and where are they going to come from and what vessels are they going to go on? Because at the moment we lack all three. And that's even before BRNC gets turned into a hotel and spa.
That's Dartmouth Royal Naval College, the Officer Training College. Yeah, I mean, whether that happened, I don't know. But I would need a huge amount of investment. But we could come back to that. But I found that officer a few editions ago, a March edition, so it was at the beginning of the year, really, because it came out in February. Commodore Ivo Vark is the commander of the Estonian Navy. So he's got only a handful of ships, and they've got dreams of increasing their capabilities, and therefore he's optimistic but pragmatic about what he's got. And the two quotes that really stuck in my mind were one where, which I pulled out in the layout so that attention could be drawn to them. It was, he said this, and this is the boss of the tiny Estonian Navy. He said, "If I have ships, I could equip these with weapons and sensors to meet our short-term requirements. If I do not have ships, then we can only respond with shore-based assets to different threats in the maritime domain." And then the other thing that I pulled out in terms of quotes that we highlighted, he said, also, "The harsh reality we are facing is that we urgently need to modernise our ageing fleet. Otherwise, we will fade out within the next decade." And then the third quote that we highlighted was, we should maintain a well-defined baseline set of core capabilities and focus on the multi-domain aspect of the naval warfare within both confined and shallow waters. I mean, that's more specific to the Baltic. But in a nutshell, I think in certainly the first two quotes, the Commodore has summed up the challenges confronting the Royal Navy as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's if you don't have the platforms to train on, if you don't go out and train in those areas that you're supposed to be a specialist in, let's look at mining countermeasure forces at the moment, you know, they will soon be better than us because they are actually going out and doing it. We are in a transformational period where we are transitioning to uncrewed platforms. But again, there's a delta, or there's a gap between getting rid of what we've got to getting what, you know, what we think will be the next panacea to solve that problem. We seem to create ourselves gaps or risks, and he's exactly right. If we don't have the platform to put stuff on, then we're all in classrooms just theoretically talking about it, and anybody can do theory. I think this was mentioned last week. I think that we're setting up another integrated warfare centre or something like that. So another two-star command being set up to talk about the future. We kind of seem to be forgetting about the now. And that's across all three services, be it the Navy, the Royal Air Force, or the Army. You know, the now is, yeah. That's where NATO needs us now. That's where our allies in the Gulf need us now. That's where Norway and those other countries need us now. And now we've got nothing to offer. And tomorrow when we turn up with all the toys to say, look, we've got all of this stuff, everybody else has moved on. Yeah, you know, we've worked out a way now that we can work without you. We don't need you now. Because we weren't there, or you weren't there when we needed you. And this is exactly what's going on in the Gulf at the moment, and why Al Khans and Luke Pollard had to do their quick tour out to those Middle Eastern countries to say, don't worry, sorry, we'll be there next time. It also got them out of the Northern Ireland vote, but that's a whole different issue.
Well, that's the two armed forces minister, or defence ministers.
That's the two defence ministers, were, yeah. You know, they did their tour of the Middle East to sort of reinforce to allies. Yeah, sorry, we forgot about you. Yeah, sorry, we pulled all of our kit out just before the conflict kicked off. But don't worry, next time we might be here.
I mean, I don't think they had any choice. I think it was end of story. I mean, even the Americans withdrew their mine hunters just before it all kicked off. But the thing I think that, and this might take us to two final topics, people don't weigh up is they talk about cost, and it's the cost and the value. So, okay, it costs a lot of money to, let's say, train a Navy, maintain somewhere like Dartmouth Royal Naval College, you know, Britannia Royal Naval College, to train your officers, and also, you know, train your ratings over HMS Raleigh at Tor Point in Cornwall as well. And it costs a lot of money to get these destroyers out of maintenance and send them wherever, or keep a ship in the Gulf. But then the cost, if it all goes wrong and you've got nothing and disaster hits you and as a strategic defeat, is actually immense. It's far more than the cost would have been had you kept a fully functioning Navy and kept it well operated and with plenty of ships and other systems and also had the people for it. But then along comes the Ukraine war that says, on land and at sea, appears to say, we could get rid of, you know, we don't need this stuff so much, so maybe we can reduce the cost and not have so many of those. But then somebody comes up with some countermeasures to those drones, like a guy in a skydiver's aircraft with a, you know, a side door with a shotgun.
Yep.
And he's shooting down drones or biplanes with a guy with, I think, a 50 caliber machine gun in it. And there are going to be countermeasures to the drones, because a drone is a weapon system above all, or it's a surveillance system. And there will be countermeasures in the future combat environment, like lasers and guns, to destroy them. So to my mind, going back to the head of that Baltic fleet, Commodore Vark, the Estonian Navy boss, he's right. You know, if you don't have any frigates or destroyers that you can put guns on to shoot down drones or lasers, you have nothing. And if you don't have people to send them to sea, which is what you were saying, you can't put them out there. So briefly digressing to the news on Dartmouth, there's an argument there, isn't there? There's two arguments. One is an academy of officer training and it's also about tradition and prestige. But is it, you know, it can't be a case of I was going to say, I won't say it, I will actually, fur coat and no knickers, which is an English phrase, which we won't explain too closely. But it can't be a case that your Navy is going to be something that has, you know, plenty of show, but when you scratch the surface or go behind the scenes, it needs a massive amount of investment somewhere like Dartmouth to bring it properly up to scratch to being that amazing academy. You have to take decisions that may seem to go against tradition and may seem to be throwing away the Navy's prestige. But, you know, if you're going to get the people through the system to operate the warships, maybe you do need to think differently. And maybe that is, and I know they've been considering it for 20 odd years, because I went to Rally 20 odd years ago and the trainers there said they could train officers and ratings together and it could make it an effective system. You know, 20 odd years ago when the magazine profiled HMS Rally, the rating school. So what do you think to the Dartmouth decision that they will have the first 11 weeks of which is basically militarization followed by introduction to marinization to the sea at with the ratings and the officers at HMS Rally in Cornwall, nearby, not far from Devonport Naval Base?
So I think the death knell of the Dartmouth Royal Naval College has already been started because someone denied that it's being disposed of. So as soon as you get a denial from government, that means it's going to happen. Anybody can watch Yes Minister to see that. The cost of running the building, the estate, when you don't invest in it, those costs just build up. It's like any stately home. That's what Dartmouth is at the end of the day. You know, these are big old stately homes that need a lot of maintenance and a lot of money to keep them running. If you look at what the Royal Air Force are doing, I think the Royal Air Force now up at Cromwell, those serving personnel do not do the first phase of officer training. They come in at phase two because they've already been militarized as much as you can get in the Royal Air Force. So they join at phase two. So that's a commonality of training structure, and it's 24 weeks, which is roughly the same as it is up at Cromwell. There is a plan for Cromwell to get the guys from Halton. So all the RAF recruits, so Halton is in the midst of being closed and they are trying to move Halton, RAF Halton, up to RAF Cromwell. So there is a single academy, a training academy, where they all
four ordinary non-commissioned people as well as officers together, is what you're saying. Yeah,
that's it. So yeah, senior NCOs, so airmen, air crew and officers are already trained at Cromwell. It's just the recruits that are trained down at RAF Halton. So they've been trying to close RAF Halton for a long time because it's prime housing estate land that they can build on to move the recruits up, and Cromwell campus is quite big, so moving all of that, so then all of a sudden you've got the recruits, the airmen, air crew, or the air crew and the officers all being trained together. It already works very successfully at Lymston Commando Training Centre, Royal Marines. However, I will caveat that to say the culture is completely different. There is, you know, people, when if they're using CTCRM as an example of where it works, the culture there is completely different. You would have to go to CTCRM and have a look at the culture there and have a look at the culture of the service establishments. And they, you know, they've been doing this since the 40s and 50s. So it's a well understood, it's a well built in sort of culture. Rally's got the campus size, it's got the waterfront. So all of a sudden you've centralized, from a purely financial point of view, you've centralized all of your small craft training to one place, which is on the jetty at Jupiter Point, which is just across from the naval base itself. So financially it makes great sense. You know, will it happen over time? Yes, it's going to happen over time. You know, Dartmouth will just become too expensive. And if you're only doing 14-week courses there now, that's three courses a year, suddenly the place is going to start looking a bit empty. And when the place starts getting a bit empty, rooms aren't used, they start getting old, blocks get closed down and they just stand there slowly decaying. I would just wish sometimes, you know, they would have the conviction in their vision by saying, yes, we are going to co-locate all Royal Navy new entrant training at HMS Rally. It's going to take us 6 years. And yes, Dartmouth Royal Naval College is to be closed and sold off. What's next? You know, move on. Society evolves. You know, what was good yesterday may not be good for tomorrow. All I will ask is that they don't build the carbuncle that they built at Whale Island, or, you know, new Navy Command HQ, because that's just a concrete blob. You know, you've got to take some thought into what your trainees, what your officer cadets are being introduced to, because they're not being introduced into a job. They're being introduced into a career and a way of life. You know, this is not a job that people go into. It's a way of life. And people, when they're doing these things, especially politicians and certain civil servants, don't seem to understand that you're entering organizations that have tradition, that have culture. Just look at the challenge in the early 1990s when Options for Change came out and regiments were being disbanded or amalgamated. That's, you know, people take these things extremely seriously, especially within the Navy and especially within the Army.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting what you say there, of course, reflecting on tradition. And the thing about Britannia Royal Naval College, you know, Dartmouth, is that it's named after a ship, you know, which was a hulk, wooden wall hulk, I believe, that was on the Dart, the River Dart. And in, you know, whenever it was, the turn of the century, at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the cadets that were trained on that hulk were brought ashore into this posh building built on the hill, which is the college that we see today. So, I mean, evolution happens, you know, and that college, that grand college, all the money, the riches of the British Empire and the Navy then suited that Navy. So I think you now need to have something that suits the Navy of today. And officer cadets are already using the naval base at Devonport and Raleigh for various things. So instead of going back and forth or whatever they do, you might as well have, as you say, have them all on a co-located site where they can be properly introduced. And of course, the officer cadets and the ratings will be trained alongside each other. It's not going to be interwoven, presumably. So, you know, it'll be a bit like, I suppose, Limpston as well. This is the people that are going to be officers are trained alongside the Marines, aren't they? They're not actually interlaced, as it were.
No, you train alongside the people that you're going to command, and you want, again, with the Royal Marines, those recruits, those young Marines want to be able to make sure and look at their young officers to say, you've been through the same stuff as we've been through.
Yeah.
That's the culture, that's the ethos that's built in. So the commando tests are the same. You know, the standard is the same across the board. Here is the pass map. Everybody's got to pass it. But for young officers, you know, it's the 30 miler, you've got to do it a bit quicker. The assault course, Tars and Assault, you've got to do it a bit quicker. But again, it's setting that, you know, I would just wish if the Navy are going to do something, if, you know, if the long-term plan is for Dartmouth to go, fine. Say it now. Take the pain now. What's next? Let's move on and let's invest in Raleigh to become the Royal Navy Centre of Excellence for training of their recruits, their air crew, and their officers. You know, let's invest the money in and move on. It's, you know, what you're going to have now is you're going to have a constant campaign in newspapers. It's, you know, it's just going to drag. It's just going to be another thing that the Navy has to manage. It's going to be another thing that politicians have to manage. First Sea Lord, yep, guess what? The plan is that we are going to dispose of it. People are going to be unhappy, but the Navy will wake up in the morning and we'll carry on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's the lack of a plan. It's where next?
Yeah.
People want to know where next. So if you, for example, you know, the landing platform docks, HMS Albion, HMS Bulwark, okay, they're going to go, shock, horror, you're actually going to get rid of them to save a few million quid and sell at least one of them to Brazil. But what's next? Have you got the plan for what's next there? And it's like, no, we haven't. We're just going to get rid of it. Why? To save a few mini quid. Well, what are the Royal Marines going to do then? How are you going to, you know, you just showed off how having a ship like HMS Albion is great in the Baltic. And I think it was the King of Sweden went on board and saw it. And I think it was 4-5 Commando, the US Marines and the Swedish amphibious forces all used that vessel to show how she could help protect the Baltic just after Sweden had joined NATO. And then what happens a few months later? You get rid of it. So, of course, the Swedes and the US Marines and everybody else are going, okay, what are you going to use instead?
What message is that? Oh, MRSS is coming soon. You mean at the top of the V? Yep. So, you know, when? Oh, it's, you know, we're looking at it in the early 2030s. Okay, we'd have all moved on by then, you know, and we're going to re-roll the Royal Marines as Tier 2, because everybody likes talking about Tier 1 and Tier 2 at the moment, which is Special Operation Forces. And we're going to move back to our roots. That's another line that likes to be used, 12-man teams, which is all cool. Gucci and we get new uniforms and we get new really expensive rifles and all the other things, the question still stands, how am I going to get my Royal Marine to battle? What platform is he going to go on to be able to get 200 miles off the shore so he can get in his little, you know, raiding craft, his little commando craft that the Norwegians are helping us buy? How are we going to get them 200 miles off the coast so they can do that? What vessel is there to do that at the moment? We haven't got one because that's an MRSS. No. And we're going to have up to six. We love hearing the word up to because it doesn't mean anything. What it really means is two or three. And again, if I'm the Treasury, I'm looking, I'm saying, well, you've managed for a couple of years without them, so why do you need them now? And again, the guy within the two-year post that said, it's not my problem, it's the guy's next, you know, that's a cultural thing to say, yep, it's the next train driver along. You know, the next train driver's responsibility is to take us from the next station to the station after that. I've done my bit. So how do I get my Royal Marines ashore? And then once I've got them ashore, how do I support them? Where is that second tier force? If you go back to Commando 2000, so the LPH and two LPDs, they were the ones that got in close. They were the ones that got the guys ashore. The landing platform auxiliaries, the Bay class, and then the Roros. That's your follow-on forces. That's the army coming along with critical mass, going back to the mass thing, to get mass ashore to allow the Royal Marines then to advance forward to go and take the next point. All of that has gone. We've now just got some great soft teams that are doing some lovely work in Norway at the moment, operating off the back of, you know, the P-2000s, like I said earlier, HMS Archer, 41 years old, no planned replacement yet. We've got OPV-1s out of service, 27, 28, 29, no planned replacement yet. You know, all of these gaps, where's the now? I go back to the sort of message, you know, there's a great future ahead. We can't even get to the first step on the ladder. There's no point in having, you know, something that's unobtainable, which I think some of these things are, because we just can't, you know, go back to your Baltic Sea Commodore. We just don't have the stuff now to allow us to build the foundation that we're going to need for the future. All of these things, you know, and I go back to when we last did the pod, or when I was last on, I still believe that we've got one aircraft carrier too many. It's not that I don't want us to have two aircraft carriers. It's just that we just don't have the budget to run both. And that money is taking us away from the fact, you know, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a couple of crewed Type 31s or another Type 26 or another submarine, another A-boat, or would you prefer another carrier? Because at the moment, we can get our carriers out operationally once every 4 years. That's not a capability, that's a gin tour.
And I think with the carriers, if they kept one in reserve and one out, then that would make more sense, because that's what we used to do with the three Invincible class carriers. There'd only ever be one or two. There was three of them. But then, you know.
Yeah, they're both ready at the same. They're both ready now. What we do, we've got two aircraft carriers that are ready to do stuff at the moment, but we've got no aircraft to put on them and no escorts to move them around. So, you know, you've reached a point where, yep, there's our two premier bits of kit. But can you deploy it as a carrier? Oh, no, we can't. We'll have to do it with allies.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, our allies are going, no, you're all right, thanks. If you look at the French carrier strike group, two frigates, two destroyers, submarine, auxiliaries, all French.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I presume, and we just have a very quick consideration of the Iran war here. I presume that when, I'm going to presume, I don't like to presume, a bit like Steven Seagal in the second one, you know, Under Siege, where the character says the assumption is the of all F-ups, you know, assuming something, it means things go wrong and you can never assume anything. But I'd assume, because HMS Dragon is going through Suez, the destroyer HMS Dragon is going through Suez and out into the Indian Ocean, to the Gulf of Aden, wherever, which is where the French are going, who we've just mentioned with their carrier strike group. I would assume that she's going to join that, which, I mean, Dragon has done that for the Americans and the French before. I mean, not Dragon, but the Type 45 destroyers have been part of the escort group. So I cannot imagine the Royal Navy is going to do any do-or-die dash into the Strait of Hormuz to do something, you know, on its own. So, you know, nor will it get really up threat with the Americans because, you know, we're famously not actually part of that gang, you know, at the moment. Yeah. So do you think that it's limited what Dragon will do and it will have to be part of what the French Counter-Strike group is doing?
Probably. I mean, a ship by itself can only do so much. So if you put it in the Straits, I think there's two early berths there at the moment. So if I'm flagged British vessels, so if I'm carrying a UK flag or something like that, and I want to get through the Straits, I'm saying who is, you know, and I'm the Lloyd's underwriter or I'm DNK, the Walrus underwriter. I'm saying, well, you know, how am I getting these goods through? Who's here to help? You know, why is Dragon going there now? It's a good question. Is she going with a full warload or is she going with a limited warload? It makes a good newspaper article that we're sending her here. But as you just said there, what's she there to do? Is she going to go and support the French? But the French have already got two air defence, you know, destroyers. If I'm the French, I've said thanks for your offer, but we're all right. We don't need you. Go and join someone else's gang. So you'll have Dragon just floating around looking for something to do. You know, it will be the same going, you know, to the point that we made earlier. Soon we'll find ourselves saying, well, we've got these things now and everybody has said, yeah, but we've worked out how to work without you now. You know, we don't need you anymore. We've adapted. We've worked out that you're not a reliable partner now because you just don't have the assets available. And we've gone in a different direction. So then, you know, we sit in a very small pond with our own, you know, with a very, very small group of friends. And we say, well, what we'll do now is we'll focus more on Jeff. You know, we're going to go and do more Jeff stuff.
That's the Joint Expeditionary Force. That's the Northern Nations Alliance, is it, in the Baltic and the North Sea and all that? Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know, and that's why you see First Sea Lord spending a lot of time up there saying, yeah, we're all going to work together, you know, doing stuff up here. Okay. That's fine. If that's a campaign, launch it as a campaign plan. Put a campaign lead and let that campaign lead say, these are all the things that I need, going back to 1941 and the Atlantic campaign, these are all the things I need to make this work. And if you haven't got submarines because you haven't got the infrastructure, please build me some SSKs instead to jump on another little hobby horse that I've got.
Yes, SSKs for the Royal Navy. We won't get down that one at the moment, but yes. But that would be common sense. And I think, again, just to conclude here, what it lacks and what it needs, not necessarily the First Sea Lord. I think he's articulated his vision, but he's the guy who's the political head of the Royal Navy working with the government to try and deliver what it is they say they want and to offer them some options to, you know, counter the Russians or whatever. So he's doing his bit, but it's the vision thing, I think, we could conclude is actually missing here. And it applies to Dragon going east to Suez. What is the vision there? Because as you've just said, other people are doing their own thing and don't necessarily need Dragon. So is it a gesture to the French? Or might it be that Dragon will end up with her amazing air defence capabilities being a backstop for the French and maybe the Americans in the Gulf of Aden, where apparently piracy's on the rise again and in the Red Sea?
Yeah, so it's getting near to that time where the Chinese are looking at moving Christmas presents.
Right.
So by about July time, they'll start moving their Christmas presents and they'll start coming around. Which route are you going to do? Are you going to go through the Red Sea or are you going to go around the Horn? Those decisions are being looked at now.
So that's the future, you know, for the Royal Navy, guarding Christmas presents. Santa's helper, perhaps?
Santa, you know, again, if you stop the flow of that traffic coming around, then it knocks a couple of points on inflation and, you know, the European economies start to, you know, that's where all our toys come from. So if you start blocking those routes, suddenly it's taking a bit longer, it's going to cost more money, it takes a bit more time. That puts pressure on inflation. We already see with oil and gas at the moment, you know, the pressures that it puts on the economy, and now exacerbate that by putting it on material goods. So think from the Far East, that's where we get our material goods. From the Middle East, that's where we get our liquid and gas goods. So suddenly we've now got two pressures on the economy. Yeah, so if it is, you know, go back to Corbett and go back to protecting sea lanes. These are sea lanes of operation where we get goods. So if HMS Dragon or HMS X is out there making sure that the reindeer deliver Christmas, that's a good political thing. You know, there's a campaign. We will make sure Christmas happens in the UK. There's a keen message to get across. But going back to your previous point as well about vision. So there's a thing in the military called SMEAC, which is situation, mission, execution, any questions, check, understanding. And you can replace the S with a V, vision, mission, execution, any questions, check, understanding. Without a vision, there is no mission. Without missions, there's nothing to execute. You know, there's no questions to ask because people don't know what's going on and there's no understanding to check. So it goes back to that core thing. You know, what is the vision? What situation do we find ourselves in? What missions are we there to, you know, to go out and achieve? And then the execution piece, how are we going to do it? Because there is a lack of clarity in that area at the moment. You know, it's bad enough in the Royal Navy. If you only look across at the Army and the challenges that they're facing at the moment as they try and work out who they are and what their role is, you know, you can see this is endemic across the fence. And that's what the SDR was supposed to help solve.
Strategic Defence Review, which was about a year ago, whatever it was.
Which was a year ago, but as Chief of Defence Staff said, that's a document that wasn't produced by his department. He said that at Defence Select Committee, it's a document that his department did not produce.
No, that was the outside visionaries whose vision was not accepted. I think we could round up there. And I think, you know, observing something, as somebody who in the past has written various things on a thing called sea blindness, which afflicts the UK's citizens, politicians, or supposedly has, where they just don't understand the sea and the connection between the sea and the things that happen upon it with the UK itself. Actually, protecting the vessels carrying all the Christmas presents from China, not obviously Santa's sleigh per se, but these vessels carrying all this stuff and everything else that comes to us from around the world via the sea lines of communication and sea lanes is actually a way of explaining to people, if only somebody would grab a hold of it and really go with it in a national campaign, this is how and why you must protect the sea lanes and the commerce and Santa's presence and energy and other goods and cars coming to us across and around the world, across the oceans and around the world. You must have a navy to do that, even now, to do that. Otherwise, you won't get your presents. You won't be able to heat your home. You won't be able to put the lights on. You won't have any food. And also under the sea, the cables that snake around the world with the communications, you can't run the stock market without them. You can't have the internet. It's all fairly simple stuff. If you have an overarching, as people like to say, vision as to why the Navy's needed and why it plays a part in that, and why we must have a strong Navy out there operating. So I think that's a good point to end on.
As Churchill said in 1941, without the Atlantic, we lose the war. That's a nice, easy, visionary statement. Without the Atlantic, we lose the war. Yeah. So sea lanes communication. So and that's the Royal Navy, that's the Royal Air Force with Coastal Command. You know, that's a whole country approach or whole country endeavour to make sure the goods, the food, the fuel and everything is coming from the United States. It's no different today. Our solid goods come from the Far East, our liquid and gas goods come from the Middle East, and our cables that run our economy is all delivered to us via the sea, not by, you know, standing up a division or a brigade in Germany, or not via, you know, GCAP or something like that, being able to deliver bombs 1,000 miles around the coast of Russia. But then, you know, we're biased because, you know, we've got a maritime focus.
Yeah.
But, you know, 99%, 90% of all trade, 99% of all communications is via the sea. And we are an island.
And that's a vision, I think, that we on Warships Pod can offer free to the world and to British leaders. And I think we should conclude there by having articulated the vision. And we've presented it. So thanks very much, Lee, for coming on.
No worries.
And I think we've done something really important there for the government. If only if it would listen. Thanks for listening to Warships Pod. For more on the state of the Royal Navy and also a lot of other naval news, features and pictures, please do take a look at the new June 2026 edition of Warships IFR, which is out now. It includes a look at naval power in a new age of imperium, the Black Sea mine menace, Australia's naval boost, and how the Royal Navy has been countering Russian intrusions. Also, There's some stuff on the Iran war and the conflict's global consequences. I'm sure you will find it a fascinating read. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.